Thanks for joining us at Shooting from the Hip. This is your host, Mark Avery. Jeff Pedro is out today. He's actually taking his son up to school, so he might get an opportunity to call in. If he does, we'll get him on the air. Maybe he'll be able to answer a few questions, too. I'm from Sim Trainer. I'm one of the instructors there. Sim Trainer is the Dayton area's first indoor range and firearms training facility, specializing in firearms training and firearms-related issues, including recreational shooting and concealed carry, advanced handgun, tactical handgun training, and various other types of training, including some non-handgun class. We have a total personal defense class that's very popular as well. So we're going to have this hour to ourselves. I want to invite you to give us a call at 457-1290, and we'll get you on the show. If you have a question about firearms or about concealed carry, about training, maybe you've heard a news story that has prompted a question, or you've seen some legislation or some discussion in the news about legislation that's pending, or maybe you received an email that told you about some terrible thing that is about to go through the Congress and you'd like to check it out, give us a call at 457-1290 and we'll get you up on the board. Last week we talked quite a bit about training, but we didn't really get completed because there's three basic fundamentals of shooting firearms, in particular handguns. And we talked a little bit about a grip and sight alignment, which are two of those three. We didn't really get to talk much at all about trigger control, and you really have to have all three of those working together in order for that to be successful, in order for you to be able to accurately and consistently place a shot on the target where you want it to go. So let's talk a little bit about that today, in the first part of the show. We talked about grip, and in grip, you need to make sure that your both thumbs are pointed on the same side of the firearm, that you've got as much of your hand on the grip as you possibly can get. You need it to be stable. You need to have a secure grip on your firearm, which helps you to manage the recoil and especially to come back on a second shot and be very accurate with it. We also talked about sight alignment, and you need for the front sight and the rear sight, when you bring them up on the target, for your eye to be aligned with the sights in such a way that when you look through them, you look through the rear sight to the front sight, you see the front sight is even across the top with the top of the rear sight, and the space that you see on both sides of the front sight is even in that viewfinder of the rear sight. And then when you do that, the sight will be lined up accurately with your eye, and you place that up on the target to create your sight picture. Where the hole will appear, where the gun will shoot, is right above the front sight. And so that's kind of a real quick summary of grip and sight alignment. Let's talk a little bit about trigger control. With trigger control, your interface with the mechanical world changes. It's completely different from everything else that we do. When I want to flip the light switch and I want the light to come on, I flip the switch when I want the light to come on it comes, and it does it right when I tell it to. If I want to turn on a water faucet, I turn the water faucet and right then the water comes on. When I want it off, I turn it when I want it to go off and it goes off. Well, you really can't do that the same way with a firearm. Now, clearly you could. You can force the gun to go off at a particular time. The problem is, because of the way that your body works, when you force the trigger to break at a particular time, your entire body gets prepared for the recoil that you know is coming, and you tend to flinch, or you tend to push the gun to expect that recoil, to anticipate that recoil. When you do that, you push the gun just a little bit off target, sometimes a lot off target. And we call that anticipating the recoil, or a trigger flinch. The problem with doing that is you can't really see that it's occurring until you've had a lot of practice watching for a trigger flinch and watching for the gun sights to be on target. You really can't see it as you're placing the shot. So you come up on target, you get your good solid grip, you get your sights aligned the way they're supposed to be on the target, and then you start to increase the pressure on the trigger, one of the things that often happens is people will wait until the sights get just perfectly aligned on exactly the place they want it to go, and then they'll give that trigger a little extra bump and hope that the hole appears right where the sights were aligned. What happens is your entire body gives a little bit of a flinch. you brace for that incoming. And when you do that, you pull the gun off the target. What you really need to do is to, instead of making the gun go off at a particular time, you have to say, it doesn't matter when the gun goes off. Now, I know it's going to go off because I have my finger on the trigger, and that's what makes it happen. So I increase the pressure gradually on that trigger until the gun goes off by itself. Now, this is a real easy thing to explain, and it's a very difficult concept for people to grasp, for people to understand until you've actually done it, and you see and you feel the difference between making the gun go off at a particular time and letting the gun go off by itself. And like I said before, it is completely different from everything else that we do in our interface with the mechanical world. I was listening to Greg Sucker in Auto Talk earlier today, and one of the guys had a problem with his ignition switch. He'd turn the switch and nothing would happen. Well, you know, we expect when we interface with the mechanical world that you turn the switch or you push the button or you turn the handle and you expect something to happen right then. Well, you know, that's just the way that we interface with the mechanical world on a routine basis. You have to take all of that and put it aside and completely change your mental picture when you go to shoot a firearm. When you get your sights aligned on the target and you begin to increase the pressure on that trigger, you just want to keep your sights aligned on the target until the gun goes off. I kind of liken it to encouraging kids to do what you want them to do. You know, how many of you out there have teenagers? I don't anymore. Mine's grown up, and she's a wonderful young woman. She does what she needs to do, and I really don't have to do this anymore because she's already got her mental picture lined up. But I do remember some times when there was a little bit of a disconnect between us, when, you know, I was convinced that the best thing to do would be to seal her in a barrel at about 14 years old and feed her in through the knot hole. And then when she turned 16, I was thinking of maybe plugging up the knot hole. Okay, well, we've grown through all of that, and we don't have to do that anymore. But when you're firing a firearm, it's very similar to that same kind of encouragement as opposed to mandate. If I can convince her that she needs to do something and then it becomes her project, that works a whole lot better, or it did. And the same thing is true with a firearm. If you can take a nice smooth trigger press, if you can increase the pressure on the trigger until the gun goes off on its own, while the whole time you're focused on the front sight, keeping the sights aligned and keeping that on, keeping constantly moving towards the place where you want the hole to appear, when the trigger finally does go off, the hole will be exactly where it was because you didn't know exactly when the gun was going to go off. You just increased the pressure on the trigger. The first thing, and I probably should have mentioned this earlier, is you need to make sure that your finger is in the right place on the trigger. And this is a fairly common problem, particularly if you have a trigger that's a little on the stiff side. Some of the revolvers have a trigger that might be up to 15 pounds or more in pressure required on the front of the trigger in order for the trigger to break. Well, if that's the case, sometimes people will hook their finger all the way into that first joint and grab it with the joint and yank back and pull back hard in order to get that trigger to break. Some other times, people will just put their finger on the trigger right near the tip of the finger. And either one of those situations is going to make it's more difficult to place an accurate shot. Because if your finger is on the tip of the finger on the trigger, you'll tend to push the trigger and the whole gun off target to the weak side. If you grab all the way into the knuckle, you'll tend to pull it. When you pull on the trigger, when you increase the pressure on the trigger, you'll tend to pull the gun off target to the strong side. If you're right-handed, that'll be pulling it off to the right side. So that just makes it more difficult to keep the sights aligned on the target as you are increasing the pressure. The best place for the finger to be on the trigger is right on the center of the pad of that first, of the between the tip of the finger and the first joint. If you're right in the center of that pad and place that right on the center of the trigger, as you increase the pressure, you'll be tending to keep the gun pointed in exactly the same direction, and then you can increase the pressure gradually, and the more gradually that you press it, the more smoothly that you press it, the more likely that you are that you'll be able to keep the trigger on or the gun on the target, and when the trigger breaks, the gun will go off. The hole will appear in the target exactly where you want it to be, and you'll be able to place an accurate shot. Let's take a break here. We'll get some. We have a lot more things to talk about here on Shooting from the Hip. Give us a call at 457-1290. You're listening to AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Rachel Parsons, spokesperson for the National Rifle Association, and you're on Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery with Sim Trainer, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip. Thank you for joining us, and if you'd like to join the show, give us a call at 457-1290. That's 457-1290, and John will get you up on the board. He will be taking your call and letting us know a little bit about what you'd like to talk about. And you can really talk about just about anything having anything to do with firearms or firearm safety, training issues. Maybe you're interested in a particular type of gun and you're looking for a firearm that you'd like to use for a personal defense, home defense, what types of ammunition to use. These are all things that we'd love to talk with you about, and I'm sure that if you have a question that somebody else out there that's listening is also interested in that topic, because there's so many different areas that people have questions about with respect to firearms and firearms issues. Give us a call at 457-1290, and we'll get you up on the air. Let's talk a little bit about some of the stuff that's gone on this week. This has been a tough week in Dayton. And if you were listening to the news at the top of the hour, you heard a story about our police chief who's been a little bit disturbed about the increase in violence. We've had 10 shootings this last week, and that is quite a few. Even for the Dayton area, which does tend to be a little bit rougher in some ways. But there is kind of an interesting story that's been missed in some of the media, and it's been reported here. There is, even though we've had this big spike, and there was another spike back in March, the total number of firearms incidents in the Dayton area is down from previous years. Richard Beal, who's the Dayton Police Chief, had said that although these are very disappointing that we have this many firearms incidents in the last week or so, he thinks that some of the projects to reduce the amount of crime is working. And in 2009, it's down from previous years in the city, and obviously that's progress. He said that since March, when there was another major spike, gun violence with injury is down 50% or more each month. And, sometimes that doesn't really seem like the case when you watch the news and you see the reports on the television or on the radio news or in the newspaper, and you see the violence that occurs and the number of people that are injured. And in many cases, like in this case, we had four of them that were killed. That's tragedy, and we should do everything we can to stop that. But what we also find is that even though those get a lot of attention, you don't hear so much about how many people are not being injured and how much reduced crime and how successful some of the efforts are to reduce the amount of crime. Now, as a person who carries a concealed handgun and is licensed to do that, I believe that part of the reason why we're starting to see a decrease in the amount of crime is because the number of citizens who are equipped to deal with a violent encounter, if that is something that somebody tries to perpetrate on them. The more we can discourage criminals from doing things they're not supposed to do because we increase their risk, the better. All too many times people have taken actions, criminals have taken actions against people because they just felt like, they could do whatever they wanted to because they were the only ones who had the tools and the will to take from someone else. And now, as more and more people, there's over 150,000 citizens of Ohio who are licensed to carry firearms. The more of those that actually do that and exercise that right under their license, the better chance that there is that somebody who is going to commit a crime is going to run into someone who's not a victim, someone who is not willing to be prey for the predators, but is instead willing to do what's necessary to defend themselves and others. Stephen in Beaver Creek has called into the show. And, Stephen, let's get you on the air. Do you have a question for us?
Yes, thank you. Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Thanks for calling the show.
Thank you for taking my call, and I'll start right in. With the change of administration and everything going on in the economy in the U.S. today, my wife and I decided it was important to go get a handgun. We bought a 9mm and the rounds for it. And my concern is, if I use this weapon in self-defense in my house or outside of my house, can I be charged with some type of unlawful possession for not registering the gun?
No. There is no requirement to register ownership of a firearm in Ohio. Anyway, obviously that's where we are. There are some states that don't allow you to own a firearm without having it registered with the authorities. We like to call those the People's Republics of, and fill in the blank. There are several places around the country where the states have more greatly infringed the right of their people to keep and bear arms. But that's not the case in Ohio. In Ohio, you're protected both by the U.S. Constitution, the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and as well as the Ohio Constitution, which has a provision that allows you to keep and bear arms as a citizen. So, now, there is no requirement that you register. Now, you live in the Beaver Creek area?
Correct, right outside of Dayton.
Okay. And in Dayton, there was at one time a requirement that certain firearms had to be registered, and that's no longer the case because in 2007, the state legislature passed a bill that preempted the entire area of firearms law and made that only the state could regulate and dictate the way that firearms are used and regulated. So it's no longer even possible for cities or counties or other municipal governments to set up a law or a regulation or ordinance that prohibits your use of firearms in any way that's different from what the state has already identified.
All right. Well, I appreciate that info, and I just wanted to let everybody know that the process was very simple. I went to the arms dealer within 5 minutes. I had my weapon, and I say that on the caveat that I was 9 years prior Army and 8 years Air Force. So it was nice to see that the process worked smoothly.
Well, and thank you very much for your service. I assume you went through the instant background check. They called the FBI, and you filled out a big form. And
correct. I filled out a form, which took longer than the transaction. And
it absolutely does.
I was out the door in about 5 minutes, and that, I felt, was directly related to my right to bear arms. So it was a good thing.
Absolutely true.
Steve, all right, that's all I had.
Well, great. Thank you very much for calling the show. I want to add just one more thing to that real quick before we take a break at the bottom of the hour, and that is that, you know, even though it's a fairly quick process, it does require a background check. It does require that the firearms dealer, if it's a federally licensed firearms dealer, contact the FBI and do an instant background check to verify that you're not on one of the prohibited lists. So we're headed into the news. Charlie will give you an update on things that are going around the area. This is AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
God bless America. This is your blood brother, Ted Nugent, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
And welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery, your host. Jeff Pedro is out for the day. I'd like to encourage you to give us a call at 457-1290 if you have a question about anything having to do with firearms. I'm here from Sim Trainer, which is the Dayton area's first indoor range and firearms training facility. If you have a question after the show or if you'd like to register for a class, you can call the range at 937-293-3914. If you have a question that you'd like to get on the air, but you maybe don't want to call or you're not able to call because either you're out of the area or you're not available at the time the show is on, you can send us an email at radio@sim-trainer.com. You can find all kinds of things about our range and the programs that we offer at our regular website, which is www.sim-trainer.com. Don't forget the dash. You'll also find the radio page at sim-trainer.com/radio. So if you just want to find out information about the radio program, or if you would like to get a podcast of the radio show, We have that available in several different formats at sim-trainer.com/radio. So you can click on the podcast link, or if you have Internet Explorer 8, that'll even light up the podcast icon, and you can subscribe that podcast and either have the program downloaded directly to your PC when it's connected, or you can link to it and click on it when you want to listen to it. You can also see the show notes from the various shows since we've been on the air. You can listen to the show online by clicking on the link. And if you would like to join us and follow us on Facebook, you can click the link for Shooting from the Hip Listeners Group, and that will take you to our Facebook group where we are, where I update periodically. And if you have questions about things, that'll give you some links to information about firearms and firearms-related issues. The range itself is located at 2031 Dryden Road in Moraine, and that's across from the DPNL maintenance yard. It's pretty easy to get to from I-75. You can take the Dryden Road exit and go north, or if you're coming from the north and you want to get off before that, you can get off where the UD Arena is, turn the opposite direction, turn right there at the bottom of the exit, or turn west at the bottom of the exit, and then go out to Broadway, which is also Dryden Road, go down across the river, and we're just down on the right across from the DPNL maintenance yard. The range is open today until about 5 o'clock, so if you just want to stop by and see what the facilities are like, you can swing by the range, or like I said, you can give the range a call at 293-3914. Let's talk to Rick, who's calling in on a cell phone. Rick, you have a question about ammunition supply.
Yeah, do you know if you heard anything from manufacturers? They supply start to loosen up a little bit.
Well, we haven't heard that directly from manufacturers, but we are actually starting to see it happen. We're able to get a little bit more ammunition than we were before. We're still on allocation. So at the range, there's a limit to how much we can get. Our suppliers are restricting to certain numbers. But currently, we're able to get more than we're using. We're still only selling ammunition to people for use at the range. But we're now having enough that we don't have to worry about whether or not we have enough ammunition for a class when those classes occur. There are still some problems with some calibers. I think 380 is probably still the toughest of the typical pistol and personal defense calibers. But most of the other calibers I'm seeing a lot more of. What is it that you have or that you've been looking for?
Well, I went to the concealed carry class. You know, I was going to deal with all the magnets. And I'm at 45 and 9 and all that. And it just really seems to be really high in price to go practice with.
Yes, it is. It is still a little high in price, and I suspect that will continue for a while. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One of them is that in December was a bottom of the prices for the raw materials. If you look at the price of lead, which is obviously a primary component, and copper, which is the primary component of the jackets as well as the case. And then also tin, which is used in both the copper, both in the brass and in the lead to harden the lead. You look at those three metals and you look at the price patterns for those three metals. There was a big spike in about 2005 as the prices start to go way up. And that was the initial driver for the cost of ammunition. And it really wasn't driven by ammunition as much as it was driven by other uses for those metals, copper for wiring and so forth. As the rest of the world has increased in industrialization, there's much more technology, there's much more electrical power that's being distributed, communications technology. There's a lot of the areas that have been kind of disconnected from the rest of the world have started to get more connected, and that requires a lot of those same metals that we use for making ammunition. So the prices of the base metals went up, and then about the middle of 2008, the prices started to come back down, and in December, they bottomed out. At that same time, the demand for ammunition was going through the roof as people were beginning to see what was happening in the election, and people were saying, I've looked at the record of these people who are currently candidates, and they don't really think that the right to keep and bear arms is what I think it is, so there's a possibility that they might try to enact some sort of a ban, and And, of course, there were several of them that had been floated at different times. Well, people started stocking up. Instead of saying, I just need enough ammunition for what I plan to use today at the range and, oh, maybe, you know, a few weeks if something goes bad. Now people are saying, well, you know, I need to have enough ammunition that will carry me all the way through the end of this administration, whenever that is, and they started stocking up.
Right.
When that occurred, a tremendous increase in the civilian demand of ammunition just overwhelmed the manufacturers. They could not increase their production rate in order to accommodate that increase in demand. That's just the nature of the business. They operate fairly efficiently. They have to, or they'd go out of business. And efficient operation means that they're running fairly near to their maximum production capacity all the time. And when they did that, when this tremendous increase occurred, they didn't have enough additional capacity to ramp up. Now, the calibers like 9mm, 40, S&W, and 45, which are used by police and military, those calibers have a lot more extra room because they do have a much greater demand, much greater production. So an increase in the civilian market isn't anywhere near as much of an increase in the total production as calibers like the 380, which doesn't have, in at least not in the United States, there aren't any police departments, and it's certainly not used by the military. That ammunition is used almost exclusively by civilians. So when the number of people that started buying ammunition increased and the amount of ammunition that they purchased was increasing, the manufacturers were completely overwhelmed.
Okay. Now, I got a follow-up question on something else, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure. Go ahead quickly.
Is it a misconception or is it true? You know, when you go through the Brady system and an instant background check, technically they're not supposed to be keeping records. I know Clinton started to and there was a lawsuit. Do you believe or what do you know if they're keeping records?
Really, they're not keeping records. The only thing that they keep is the fact that there was a call and the code that they give back to the gun dealer. And they write that in on the form that when they get an approval code back, they write that code down, and that's really all they keep. And here's the reason, the indication that we have that says that that's really the case. If you are a person who has maybe a common name and you buy more than one gun, the first time you buy the gun, if it comes back and it's delayed and then you have to go back later after a few days and then it's been approved, every time you buy a gun, you'll find that exact same experience because they don't keep any information about who it was, only the fact that it occurred, the date that it occurred, and the code that they used to say that this was approved or whatever the resolution of that call was. Now,
okay.
It's possible for you as a person who buys guns to say, look, I'm tired of going through this nonsense. I would like to have a voluntary appeal file created. It's basically a good guy list that the ATF then or the FBI can then keep and say, all right, when this person comes in, we've already done a check. They really are a good guy, even though they've got a name that's similar to somebody who's a bad guy or might be a bad guy. So, yes, I really do think that they're not keeping the records. The records are kept by your gun dealer. They have to keep those forms for 20 years. But there is no automated way for them to do a trace. They'll look at the gun. They'll say, okay, this gun was purchased, and they don't even have the information on the gun itself. They have to go to the manufacturer to find out who they sold that gun to, and then they can trace it backwards that way. So, yeah, I really do think that that information is not kept. And the same thing is true for your application for concealed carry, that none of the information that comes back, including your fingerprints that went out, none of that information is kept more than 20 days by the Sheriff's Department. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, good information. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks very much for calling, Rick. Let's take a break and pay a few bills. We'll come back in just a few minutes with more of Shooting from the Hip. We'll talk to Ed in Midway. If you've got a question, give us a call at 457-1290. This is Mark Avery for Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Randy Rogers from Team Glock, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
And welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Mark Avery. Thanks so much for listening. We've got a whole bank of phone calls on the line, so let's go directly to the phones and talk to Ed in Medway. Ed, you have a call about concealed carry.
That's right.
What's your question?
I was wondering about carrying in public parks like George Rogers State Clark Park.
Okay.
And in the past, they've had it posted.
Yes.
And,
go ahead.
And I don't know if it's still legal or not.
Well, it is legal. The question is, they may still be posted. Some of those signs haven't been taken down. But the state law has changed. It changed in 2007, and then it was tested in the courts because there were several municipalities that said, hey, we have home rule, and we think that we should be able to control what happens in our parks. And the Supreme Court of Ohio said, not so fast. The city of Clyde was the case that the Buckeye Firearms Association had brought. And they basically lost their case. The city of Clyde was told, no, you may not prohibit firearms because the state legislature did exactly what they said they did. They wrote the law in such a way that they preempt all of the area of the firearms regulation, and it is not permitted for a municipality to regulate that and to ban firearms carry.
They still have one old house that's posted, and that's one. Can they post the house separately from the park?
Well, the house itself would probably be considered a government building, and if it's occupied in any way, if there's an office space in there, if they use that for an office in any way, a government office of some kind, then it would be possible that would be not exempted from the prohibition. So government buildings are considered off-limits, and anybody that has a license to carry concealed needs to know that, whether it's posted or not. But the requirement now is that the building be occupied. In other words, that it be an office building of some sort.
It's just open for floors. It's all open for.
Okay. Well, there may be some confusion about that, and there may be – I wouldn't go out of my way to go someplace that was posted, even if I know that it's a government building and that it is unoccupied, because it's possible that might not necessarily be a government building. It's possible that there could be some other reason why it'd be posted. Hey, Ed, thanks very much for giving us a call. Let's talk to Hank in Dayton about another concealed carry question. Hank, are you there?
Are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, I went to classes about a year and a half ago, but I never applied for my license. And my question is can I still apply, or do I have to go to class again?
No, you have up to 3 years from the time that your certification was complete in order to apply. And I would recommend that you do that fairly soon, because in October, I believe it's October 17th, the price is going to go up from $55 for the five-year license to go up to $67. And at that same time, your renewal cost will drop to $50. So this would be a good time to do that if you don't already have if you have completed all the requirements but haven't completed the application and made your application.
Oh, okay, that's great. All right, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks for calling the show. Let's talk to Sherry in Dayton. Sherry, you have a question on concealed carry.
Hi, yes. I was wondering, do you have to take the class in the same county that you're applying?
No, you don't. In fact, you can take the class anywhere in the state, and in fact, you don't even have to have had the class in the state, although we highly recommend it. It just has to meet the requirements. So you have to have had like an NRA basic pistol class, which is 10 hours, but then they also have to add an additional 2 hours. The total length needs to be a 12-hour class. I highly recommend, of course, I'm not like I'm biased or anything, but I think, Sim Trainer is a great place to take that class. But if you've had the class in one county and you live in another county, that's perfectly all right.
Okay, I have another question.
Okay, real quickly.
Are you allowed to qualify with a very old gun, like a .22 revolver?
You're allowed to. There's no requirement that you qualify with the handgun that you're going to carry. However, we strongly recommend that you do at least use a personal protection caliber. So a .22 really doesn't qualify for that in sense of the – although it can be very dangerous, it's not really suitable for personal protection. It doesn't quite have enough the size of the bullet and the power, the energy that's transmitted with the bullet is simply not an effective use for personal defense. And so we recommend that you not carry anything for personal defense, your primary personal defense, less than a .380, a 9mm, .40 Smith & Wesson, .45, something like that is much a better answer. And we recommend that you qualify with something like that, because if something were to happen and things didn't go exactly as planned, if you had qualified with something much smaller than what you're carrying, there could be some sort of an argument about that. Legally, from a criminal perspective, not so much, but from a civil liability perspective, it's possible that somebody could make an argument that, well, you didn't qualify with the same gun that you were carrying. It's not a legal requirement, but it's not a bad idea to qualify with at least something about the same power, the same kind of size that you were planning on carrying.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for calling the show. Let's talk to Mark in Dayton. Mark, what can we do for you on Shooting from the Hip?
Yes, sir. My question was, have you heard of the 50 caliber uppers that attach to the AR-15 lowers?
I have, a 50 Beowulf.
Yeah, well, yeah, the Beowulfs do, and I'm actually talking about the BMG uppers. There's a website called BohicaArms.com, and they sell a 50 caliber BMG upper that attaches to an AR-15 lower.
What, is it single shot? I can't imagine that a 50 caliber BMG is going to fit through the magazine.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's a single shot bolt action, and they have a bolt that comes back, and yeah, it's single shot. My question is, can an AR-15 lower handle that, or I've heard some people talk about the pins bending and stuff like that. I just didn't know if you had heard anything about that.
I am not enough familiar with that to answer the question, because I think that certainly could be an issue, but it would depend entirely on what they use to absorb the shock in the upper. I mean, if they have some sort of a recoil buffer, or they have some sort of if it's sprung in such a way that it absorbs and reduces the impulse that you would get from a 50 BMG round. 50 BMG is a big round, so I wouldn't want to put that on an AR frame myself, but that's a pretty big gun. Hey, thanks for calling the show. Let's go talk to Kevin in Huber Heights. Kevin, are you on the air with us?
Yeah, how you doing?
Pretty good. Give us a call. What can we answer your question? We've only got just about 30 seconds left.
Okay, I got like a 22 Ruger.
Okay.
It's roughly about 4 or 5 years old.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, on certain shells, when they go to kick the empty shell out, they always get jammed in, you know, before that door closes.
Okay.
Is it just the gun, or is it just the shells that...
It could be that the rounds that you're using don't have enough power. Some of the semi-automatic handguns require that you have a little bit hotter round.
Well, this is like the rifle.
It's a rifle. Well, that's the same as true for the rifle as well. And you just need to find one that works, or make sure it's really clean. If it's not cleaned and lubed enough, sometimes that'll do it too. Hey, thanks so much for calling the show, everybody. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody. Give us a call earlier in the show tomorrow, next week, 2 o'clock on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.